We have a fantastic panel on a really important topic. My name is Alex Haynes. I'm a professor of surgery at the Harvard Medical School and a surgical oncologist at MGH. I want to thank the college for allowing us to bring together this panel here on the 10th anniversary of the WHO Surgical Safety Checklist. I also want to thank Lifebox, which is an organization dedicated to surgical safety that has helped tremendously in the organization of this panel. And we have a tremendous group of speakers here today to help share their experiences with surgical safety in the in various parts of the world. 10 years ago, a group of us came together in Geneva at a series of meetings and thinking about how we could help improve surgical safety in various different environments all over the world. We had people coming from all parts of the world, from all different disciplines involved in perioperative care. And through the hard work of that group came up with the WHO Surgical Safety Checklist. The checklist was formally launched in June of 2008, just over 10 years ago. And we are excited now to take some time to reflect back on the 10 years and what has happened in the ensuing time. There's been a ton of enthusiasm for the checklist in a variety of environments. There's been enthusiasm about how it can play a vital role in helping perioperative teams communicate better, be more consistent in the care they can deliver, and that ensure as surgical care expands in its ways of improving people's health, that people are able to access the highest quality, safest surgery possible. But at the same time, there's been a tremendous amount of challenge around implementation, both around ensuring that the checklist is able to reach all the places that it can have its effect, and that when it does reach places, that it's implemented in a way that is effective, not just hanging on the wall as decoration in the operating room, but actually as a tool to affect positive change in the operating room. So here, over the next hour and a half, we're going to explore some of those issues. I hope that this will be an interactive session with lots of back and forth discussion. We're going to start off the session with a number of talks from speakers who've come from around the world to join us. And I'm going to have my co-moderator here, Dr. Thomas Weiser, come up and give us a brief overview of the talks we're going to have. So thank you again and look forward to a lively discussion.
So thank you all so much for joining us. They've gone overboard by giving us an extra big room. So it's great to mostly fill it. So I'm Tom Weiser. I'm a general and trauma surgeon at Stanford University, and I was fortunate enough to join Alex and Atul Gawande on the initial checklist work. And we have four amazing panelists who I want to introduce. So Dr. Gawande is a surgeon and public health researcher, and he was also the lead for the Safe Surgery Saves Lives program from WHO. And is the founder of both Lifebox, which is an organization you'll hear a little bit more about over the coming talks, as well as Ariadne Labs, which is a health system innovation laboratory, for want of a better word. Dr. Titina Ngusi-Mamo is a pediatric surgeon from Black Lion Hospital. She's an assistant professor of surgery at Addis Ababa University, and she's also the lead of the Lifebox Clean Cut program, which is a program focused on reducing surgical site infections through the use of the checklist. Dr. Adriana Serna Lozano is a thoracic surgeon from Bogota, Colombia. She comes to us. She is at Santa Clara Hospital at the Bosque University, and I understand that she's joined by a group of her Colombiano friends. So we're hoping for some good energy from the crowd. There we go. Thank you. And then Prof. King David Yawe is the president of the West African College of Surgeons. He is a general and breast and endocrine surgeon based at the University of Abuja and the Abuja Teaching Hospital in Nigeria. And we are delighted to have these panelists. What we'll have is Dr. Gawande start, and then we'll move straight through the panelists and then trying to be fairly expeditious because, as Alex said, we'd like this to be as interactive as possible. So Dr. Gawande.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you all for coming. 10 years ago was the official establishment of the WHO Safe Surgery Checklist. I want to tell you a little bit of the backstory behind it and then where it has come And I'll touch on a little bit of what I talked about yesterday and then add on some information specifically about the checklist. So it started in 2006 when the WHO had begun a body of work in patient safety. They had introduced what was called the Clean Hands Program that introduced globally the concept of alcohol-based hand rubs and demonstrating that you could have marked reductions in hospital infection by making it easier for clinicians to be able to just simply clean your hands in places where you don't have sinks in outside every room. And making the very practical set of moves that included even establishing a very simple recipe that hospitals could manufacture their own alcohol-based hand rubs without having to purchase from elsewhere. And so out of the spirit of that work, which became a incredibly successful global effort that relatively rapidly was able to change the standard to be to include alcohol-based hand rub and not just soap for hand washing for most hygiene needs, they then said, what do we take on next? And what they had recognized was that there was a tremendous volume of interest growing in the surgical field from a public health point of view. And it was related to the public health reality that as the economies of the world improved and as skills improved and capacity improved in being able to address early childhood disease and illness and infectious disease, we still have a long way to go at childbirth and infection control. But as those were improving, we were seeing the aging of the population globally. And you saw the replacement of diseases of early childhood illness, such as respiratory disease and consequences of malnutrition, saw those being replaced as the number one killers in the world by cardiovascular disease, by chronic disease. In the top five were traumatic injuries, including road traffic accidents, and cancer had climbed in the top 10. They were observing that the volume of surgery had grown, ended up growing in almost every country in the world except for those that were at war. Tom Weiser actually led a group that subsequently documented that we now are up to 330 million operations worldwide. About one for every 22 people that are on Earth in any given year has an operation. That volume reflects the change in the medical needs of populations. And what they were seeing was that as that volume of surgery grew, that we were having an explosion in the number of people who were not getting safe surgery. The estimates were of over more than greater than 7 million dead or disabled as a consequence of avoidable complications of surgical care. And so they contacted my group at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health in 2006 asking if we would lead a group to look at what are the guidelines that WHO could implement, could endorse for how to address reducing deaths and complications in surgery. Ultimately, I agreed to do it, but on the condition that we went further than just issuing guidelines. Some of what we got to talk about yesterday when I gave a lecture upstairs was that our usual way of dealing with delivery of better ideas in healthcare has been to first say, well, let's teach people the right thing to do. And then when we're frustrated that we aren't getting the results that we need, we then start saying, well, let's mandate that people do the right things. And so that's where you get stacks of guidelines issued by organizations like the World Health Organization. But you don't get a tremendous amount of change. You see some early adopters who are able to take a thick book that's 250 pages long that might have some guidelines and get some ideas that they're able to bring into action. But the vast the vast population of the world, it never happens. And the amazing thing was that WHO agreed to enter into this with a plan that we would deliver not only a set of guidelines around surgery, but then we would try and experiment in testing an approach for trying to drive implementation of those guidelines. Now, our original plan when this started to happen, when we first had our meetings there, was to just pick one of the guidelines. We had 10 different guidelines ranging from making sure you have some basics in place around infection control to having, as they call it, your swab counts correct, to proper identification of the patient, to dealing with things that range from teamwork to bleeding control and so on. And our thought was, let's pick the one that we could really focus on. And taking a lesson page from the group who had done infection control in hospitals, we said, let's look at infection control. And even there, let's narrow in on appropriate antibiotic administration, you know, because there was strong evidence that giving an antibiotic after incision had no benefit and, in fact, increased risk of resistant infection. And the common pattern in the world was giving an antibiotic after the incision was made or hours before surgery when the tissue levels were not appropriate. And then continuing the antibiotic for days afterwards, where you not only had no benefit, but you were creating super resistance. And we said, let's focus on that and making sure that people got the administration of the antibiotic within the first 60 minutes before incision. And the level of disappointment in the room at that being our global effort, the first time you've brought surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, biomedical engineers together to say, let's not just issue guidelines, let's do something about the death rates in the world. You know, we've gone through and we're figuring out millions of people were having complications that were avoidable. And we began poking around to say, what are the ways to make it simpler to do more of these kinds of tests of change? Johns Hopkins had, around that time, just come out with their results in the state of Michigan demonstrating that a checklist for a relatively simpler procedure than we do in surgery, a central line insertion in the ICU, could eliminate across the state in a typical quarter that the average hospital could go down to zero infections in their ICU by following a team checklist involving the doctor who is inserting the line and a nurse checking a few simple things were taken care of, from gowning and gloving to appropriate draping to appropriate application of a sterile dressing. Well, that was an inspiration for us to think, could we go more widely? There was about 6 months that passed between our initial meeting, assigning out the work for writing the guidelines, and having this debate about what we could do, to recognizing that this might be an opportunity. And we ended up being able to bring onto the WHO team the lead safety engineer for Boeing. And he taught us how to think in human factors terms in creating checklists that were not merely tick box efforts, but were designed to enable even expert leaders and teams to do better than they normally do. The critical things were looking at what even the best performing places in the world would miss as a matter of routine practice. What they called the killer items that you need to figure out how to make it easier to proceed. Second, they wanted us to understand, they helped us walk through the concept of a pause point, identifying a moment in the flow of all the complex things that happen, whether in a cockpit or the even more complex world of the operating room. And when is the moment that you can pause, catch a problem, and it's not too late, but it's also a safe moment to have a team pull their attention away for a minute and take some action. Third, they taught us, measure the time. Recognize that if you go on too long, that you can end up distracting people from the core work of what they're trying to do. But the ultimate thing you were aiming to do was enable a team of people to communicate well enough to know, did the main things that matter in your experience in the operating room, the things that are known to be beneficial or suspected to be highly beneficial, could you make checks on them? Could you make it swift and efficient? And could you then test it for whether it could have impact? The Safe Surgery Checklist then identified three pause points. A pause before the induction of anesthesia, a pause before the incision, and a pause before the patient leaves the operating room. They identified mainly communications elements. Have you introduced everybody in the room by name so they could speak out loud? Did you review what the major medical issues of the patient are, what the major non-routine concerns of the operation are? Has the nurse specified what equipment there is and whether all the infection procedures have been met? And then again, a similar kind of pause about what the plan is before you leave the operating room. We ended up deploying that in 8 cities with a result, as I talked about yesterday, where in very carefully selected sites that were enthusiastic about giving it a try, with weekly support from our team, they could implement this and achieve a 47% reduction in death on average, an extraordinarily higher result than we imagined it achieving. In the time since, in the decade since, has ensued, yes, as Alex said, some enthusiasm, a fair amount of skepticism. How can it be that you would get these kinds of results in mortality? Some outright opposition. But over time, I think what we've begun to recognize, and we now have a decade of accumulated experience with implementing this work, and we've learned that it, of course, depends on your approach to implementation and the setting, but we have some patterns of findings where we are seeing places that can achieve, like in Scotland, in preliminary data after their first 3 years, they had a 26% reduction in death. We have some data now being submitted after 5 years in Scotland about where they are. In France, a 35% reduction in death. In Norway, rolling it out as an RCT, a 43% reduction in death. But then in other places where it was just mandated, such as in Ontario, a 0% reduction in death. We've completed this year evaluation of a little more than 5-year set of work in South Carolina, where we had demonstrated a multi-step process that if the hospitals walk through that process, they achieved a 22% reduction in death compared to places that did not walk through that process. And what we came to realize is a kind of formula that I think underlies how you create change in organizations generally, where you're trying to create systems that make it easier for people to get the right kinds of things done, whether it's in surgery or in other areas we've been working on, in childbirth and end-of-life care and primary health care. If you have a systems tool that has been carefully crafted around the killer items, the failure points that even experts fail at, have an implementation pathway, and then bring it into a ready environment where people are capable and they're motivated, you can get effective adoption of a process solution, better delivery of care, and better patient outcomes. It's a challenge in fundamental ways to our values, because we have valued in our life as surgeons our autonomy as the clinician. And here was a approach which required you to work with different values: humility, discipline, teamwork. And the critical aspects of the work that I talked a little bit about yesterday was that the team found in South Carolina that the predictor of how much change you get is how effective your implementation was in changing the culture to be more team-oriented. And you could recognize it by how much change you saw in what the frontline people reported as how much that they are respected, how much clinical leadership was actually involved in the way the team works. And the ultimate test, how assertive could people be in raising issues? Did they feel safe to raise issues, not get their head bitten off, but in fact find that their what they offered had value? When you find that a part of the checklist is not executed on, could you say so and call a halt and say, I have a question here? Each 1 point improvement in that assertiveness score was a 29% associated decrease in postoperative mortality. This is why implementation takes time, and I think we'll have a panel of people talking about how you would think this simple checklist, which is literally something that you can do next week in your operating room, could nonetheless take weeks, months, and in this case for a large population, 3 years of time to be able to roll out. We talked yesterday about some of the subsequent work that has come out of this, with graduation to creating now emergency checklists for common breakdowns that occur, the most common ways that operating room care breaks down. And what we found was, with a 5-minute training and having access to these reference materials, if you have a place that's already implemented the safe surgery checklist, that implementing the crisis checklists could allow a 75% reduction in the likelihood of missing life-saving steps in crisis situations. Recently, and this I didn't get to talk about yesterday, but Alex Hannenberg in the audience, former president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, carried out a study of implementation of emergency manuals and checklists. There have been now more than 10,000 downloads by individuals of the checklist. That doesn't mean that they were downloaded. He carried out with the team a 22-item adoption survey. 1,700 downloaders responded. And what we were looking at was, of those who were able to achieve a of those responders, how many were able to achieve a successful implementation in their operating rooms? And the critical factors that turned out to make a difference: smaller places tended to be more likely for an individual person to download a tool and get the organization on board with making a change. They were critically dependent on having leadership support, having the presence of a champion, having time to actually train staff. How much they reported the providers resisted the tool. So was it a motivated environment or not? When they had more intense resistance, they of course had great difficulty doing better. And there was a powerful association with the number of implementation steps that they carried out. The implementation steps are not complicated to describe, but complicated to execute. Present the tool at your meetings. Customize it, make it your own. Pilot it, train people to at least some degree in it, provide some ongoing feedback on the use of the tool, monitor its use, and then in the ideal world, you expand the use, in this case of crisis checklists, because you can apply these to IR, to cardiology, to emergency situations. But with each added step, you had a higher and higher likelihood of achieving a successful implementation. For those of you who are interested in moving beyond the routine checklists, I'll point you to emergencymanuals.org, where we have tools and resources to join that community. We're in the hundreds of hospitals, but we have thousands as the level that we would need to get to really establish it as our next area of care. As we're moving forward, we've established 6 years ago Lifebox. That's a organization focused on bringing systems tools to the low-income and middle-income parts of the world. We're now implementing in more than 100 locations around the world. We've succeeded in bringing safety equipment, a pulse oximeter, to more than 25 countries worldwide and lowered the cost and price of implementing. But it is a space in which We've had tremendous support in the anesthesiology community to bringing the checklist into operating theaters around the world and the basic elements involved. But we've not had the same level of involvement and participation from surgery, and we're now ramping up our effort to bring surgeons to be more closely involved, in particular in Ethiopia and in India. And you'll be hearing about some of those efforts as we talk here. But I'll just recommend to you, if any of you wish to join, or for $250, deliver a pulse oximeter and training behind the pulse oximeter to enable it to be part of a checklist implementation in the lowest income parts of the world. You're welcome to look at our website, lifebox.org. And with that, thank you, and I look forward to the discussion with the panel.